We've got several bills on our agenda today. I'd like to move as quick as we can through the agenda. I have several committee members that have got other obligations this morning, so if we can move the agenda, then my committee can take care of their other obligations. First on the list is House Bill 2530. I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2530. John, will you give us a brief summary?
As Chair Starr, members of the committee, House Bill 2530 amends current statute, ORS 819.120, by eliminating the authorization that the local authorities have right now on immediate removal of a motor vehicle from the highway. Currently in statute, there is a 24-hour notice that is given before taking an abandoned vehicle. But on an abandoned vehicle, according to this statute, which constitutes by definition a hazard or an obstruction to a motor vehicle traffic using the road or highway, this bill would amend the authorization to remove the vehicle and allow 12-hour notice to be given before removal of the vehicle, and also a request for a hearing within 5 days from the date of notice. There is no revenue impact, and there is no fiscal impact on this bill.
Thank you. Kurt Curtis. Welcome.
Good morning, Chair Starr, members of the committee. My name is Kurt Curtis, and I'm a sergeant with the Oregon State Police Patrol Services Division. I come to you today with regards to some concerns that we have with regards to this bill, especially amendments with regards to Section 120 of the abandoned vehicles under 819.120. Currently, removal of a hazardous vehicle is judgment call with regards to the officer at the time of their observation of the vehicle and the situations and surrounding circumstances at that time. It could be a situation where you have a vehicle out on a section of roadway that's not a hazard at all, you have a snowstorm come in, or you have fog come in, and all of a sudden that vehicle presents a danger to traffic out there on the roadway. By putting a 12-hour time limit on this in the removal of a hazard, and you convolute the situation where if it's not a hazard, it's sitting out there for 12 hours, why couldn't it be out for 24 hours, which is under the current statute of 110? We have no problem with them being out there for the 24-hour period. Our situation, though, is the fact that if we come across the abandoned vehicle that is a hazard, we want the authority to be able to remove it immediately. We don't have time for officers to sit around or babysit the vehicle for any period of time. Because of manpower and the amount of mileage that we have to travel, and that's consistent with the cities and counties, we don't have the staffing to be able to just assign someone to stay in that area to make sure that nobody hits that vehicle or there's not a chance that somebody's going to hit it. We would like to be able to keep the statute as it is so that we have a clear-cut way to remove the vehicle without any type of argument that would come up with the administrative hearing that is available to the subject if they do contest the towing of the vehicle, which is under statute. We start mincing 12 hours, 24 hours. If the vehicle's not a hazard by our officers, whether it be on the shoulder, and it doesn't appear that it's going to be a hazard, they're going to leave it there. And many times these vehicles will sit for 2 to 3 days before we get a tow truck or get an officer back through that say this vehicle is still there. But if it is a hazard, we want the authority to be able to remove it right away to make it clear and decisive action on our part so we don't take the chance of having to come back and investigate an accident or a fatality at that location because of that vehicle.
Thank you very much for your question or your testimony. Are there any questions?
I would have
Representative Donner.
Thank you. Do the police always call the tow company to tow it, or can a tow company be driving down the road, see a car there, and decide to pick it up and take it?
Chair Starr, Representative Zoner. With regards to removal, if a tow company comes down the road and just removes the vehicle, that's theft. That's unauthorized. They don't have permission to do that. We don't have that in our statute for them to remove it. We would call as an agency to the tow company for removal of the vehicle and then have the officer stand by until the vehicle is removed. And then at that point in time, if it's removed as a hazard, it's automatically entered into the LED system. So if somebody comes back looking for their vehicle, they call the police agency, it'll come up as a hit that it was towed and where it's at, so it's not reported as stolen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Representative Rosenbaum?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm not sure, I haven't had a chance to look at the bill in detail, but what are the sections that would take away your ability to make that immediate removal when there is a hazard?
Representative Kirstar, Representative Rosenbaum, basically on the bill with regards to Section 3 here, where it says if it's parked along the shoulder area of the roadway that it can be there for 12 hours, it presents a problem because of the fact that technically you've got one section of the bill that says it can be removed immediately if it's a hazard. If it's on the shoulder area, we're going to leave it for 24 hours. If for some reason we tow the vehicle as a hazard, say 8 or 9 hours later, then we have a convoluted situation because the law says it has to be 9 hours, this type of thing. We'd like to make this as clear and cut as possible so that we don't have to go in to debate arguments with regards to, well, it was 8.5 hours or 11 hours before it was towed as a hazard. So we have one statute under 120, which specifically goes to removal of hazards, very clear and cut and dry as to what a hazard is and when it can be removed. And then we have the other statute, which is just a regular abandoned vehicle, which we do allow vehicles that are on the shoulder and not a hazard to traffic to stay there for up to 24 hours already.
Yeah, I think I understand. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony today. I appreciate you taking your time.
Thank you for your time.
Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House Bill 2530? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2530. And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2411. And certainly, can you again brief us on the bill? And then we've got an amendment that should have been delivered to your office, committee members. -1 amendment.
Thank you, Chair Starr, members of the committee. We've already had a hearing on House Bill 2411. Just as a reminder, it prohibits carrying a minor, which is defined new in the bill, a person under the age of 18, on an external part of a motor vehicle, which includes the open bed, hood, fender, or running board while on a highway, provides exemption for carrying a minor in an open bed of a motor vehicle if the minor is secured with a safety belt or a safety harness that complies with administrative rules. Now, in your -1 amendment, as you see in the summary that was provided you, that there are two exemptions in the -1 amendment that are new. It provides an exemption if all passenger seats are occupied and minors are transported in the course of farming or ranching activities. And the second exemption is if the motor vehicle is operating in an organized parade. You have a new fiscal statement on this -1 amendment. As you can see, there is no adverse fiscal impact on this amendment.
Is there any questions of committee of staff at this time? Okay, Representative Shetterly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Lane Shetterly, State Representative, District 34. I appreciate the chance to be in front of you today, and I appreciate your taking this back up. The -1 amendments are amendments that I requested based on the testimony that was presented to you at the last hearing and sort of discussions with the chair as to the direction where things were going with this bill. I guess what I would say about the amendments, I don't endorse them particularly. I certainly will accept them as part of the bill as a compromise, and that's what this process seems to be about, to move this bill forward. They do exempt the carrying of minors in the case of an organized parade, and frankly, that's just one that we hadn't thought about. Seems like a pretty fair one. The other one accommodates the concern raised by the Farm Bureau, and again, I'm happy to do that. We've had a good working relationship, and I know we will in the years to come. And that is that it allows carrying minors in the open bed in the course and scope of farming or ranching activities. The condition on that, of course, being that the other passenger seats in the vehicle be occupied by minors. So you basically don't have the grown-ups sitting in the cab and throw all the kids in the back. If there's seat belts available, those should be used for kids and let the adults put themselves on the line. But with those amendments, it's my understanding that Farm Bureau, Jean Wilkinson is here. She doesn't plan to speak to it. It's my understanding they're satisfied with it, and that we'll suspend their opposition to the bill here, and we'll not get in front of the bill in the Senate. And with that, I'm happy to see this bill move forward with these amendments.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions, Representative Shedley? I don't see any.
Okay.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience who wants to testify regarding the Dash 1 amendment, South Plus 2411? Anybody? We'll close the public hearing. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2411. And I will open a work session on House Bill 2411. Representative Brown.
I move the Dash 1 amendments to the bill, 2411.
Representative Brown has moved the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2411. Yeah. Discussion. Nobody wants to talk about this?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair.
Representative Merkley.
Sounds like a reasonable compromise.
Sounds like a reasonable compromise. Any other comments? Discussion?
Well, Mr. Chair, I like the bill a lot the way it started, but I certainly want to see the bill move, and so if this is necessary to its speedy progress, I will support the amendment.
Very good. Any other comments, questions? Is there objection to the motion? Seeing no objection, the bill is amended. Representative Brown?
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2411 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Brown has moved House Bill 2411 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion about that? I don't see any. Kate, can you call the roll, please?
Representative Brown.
Aye.
Devlin.
Aye.
Truss.
Excuse.
Murphy.
Aye.
Nelson.
Excuse.
Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Roger. Aye.
Donner.
Aye.
Starr.
Aye. Motion passes. Representative Devlin will carry. Thank you, Representative Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That will close the work session in House Bill 2411. We will go to House Bill 2681. Open the public hearing on House Bill 2681. John, will you tell us about the bill, and then we've got two sets of amendments, Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments.
Thank you, Chair Starr and members of the committee. House Bill 2681, we've heard before also. As you know, it prohibits carrying an animal, an external part of a vehicle in space intended for carrying a load unless the animal is cross-tethered or protected by a container or a cage. Exempts the transportation of livestock, exempts transportation of dogs for ranching or farming purposes, exempts dog owner operating motor vehicle who is either owner or employee of ranch or farm operation, provides exemption for a dog and motor vehicle on a highway that is not an interstate designation, not within city limits of a population of 5,000 or more. However, since our first hearing on the bill, we've had two Dash amendments submitted on this bill. The first one proposes an exemption for a person who is involved in ranching or farming activities and a dog that is injured and being transported for medical purposes. If you recall, the issue of the animal being transported for medical purposes was raised by the committee. And then the second proposal, and I'm sure there's someone here to qualify why the distinction between the two amendments, provides an exemption for a dog being transported for ranching or farming purposes and dog that is injured being transported for medical purposes. It seems like there is a fine line, and I'm sure there's people here to explain the distinction.
Very good.
There is no adverse fiscal impact yet, fiscal statement on the Dash both amendments before you.
Very good. Is there anyone? No one signed up to testify on this bill or the proposed amendments. Anyone wish to testify? Teresa, do you want to come up and comment on these amendments?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Teresa Miller, and I'm representing the Oregon Humane Society. The reason that we had the Dash 2 amendments drafted was mainly in response to some concerns that some legislators had that the language in the Dash 1 amendment was not clean enough and it was ambiguous. So we, frankly, we don't have a preference of one or the other. We would support the committee's decision to move forward with either of the amendments. But we did have the Dash 2 amendments drafted because of some concern that the language of the Dash 1, that a person's actively engaged in ranching or farming activities, was just a little ambiguous and unclear what that meant. So we did have the Dash 2s drafted in case the committee wanted a little bit cleaner language.
Great. Thank you very much. Any questions, Teresa? Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I had a conversation with a member from Pendleton, and he was concerned that the Dash 1s, we created a different class of Oregon citizen. We'd have two classes of citizens. If we adopted that, you'd have somebody that's actively engaged in ranching and farming that takes their dog in the back of their pickup to go to the town to go shopping or to the mall or whatever when they're not actively engaged in farming or ranching at that particular moment in time. So I believe that's one of the reasons, or the reason why the other amendments were drafted. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House Bill 2681? I don't see anyone. We're actually going to take some more time with this bill. I don't intend to go into work session this morning on it. So with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2681, and we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2565. And John, if you can refresh our memory, and then we've got a Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2565.
Thank you, Chair Starr, members of the committee. House Bill 2565 requires dealers selling recreational vehicles under conditional use permits to disclose business name, street address for dealer's place of business, and street address for a service facility maintained by dealer. Requires dealers selling recreational vehicles to maintain service facility for recreational vehicles at locations certified by Department of Transportation. And if you recall, those interested and sponsoring this bill were concerned about some of the generalization of the bill, and so they have produced this couple, well, there's actually four changes here as far as the Dash 1 amendment. In the bill now, in the amendment, it actually applies only to new recreational vehicles. If the amendment further defines what an RV service facility is, it further defines what an RV show is, and it establishes new provisions for regulating RV shows. We do not have a new fiscal statement on this. It takes time. We got the Dash 1 amendments late Monday afternoon, but I have spoken with fiscal office, and they do not anticipate an adverse impact to this bill.
Thank you very much. Sean Miller and Roger Kirshner. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Sean Miller, I represent the Oregon Recreational Vehicle Dealers Association. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today on 2565. Since our last hearing, we have met with the Department of Transportation, the Business Regulation Department, to work on language that would do and accomplish what we were after. If you remember from our last hearing, the industry, without franchise laws in the state, has had a problem with the out-of-state dealers coming in and the fly-by-nights, if you will, that come in, travel around the state, sell vehicles, they go back home. And then there's no one to service those vehicles. Unlike if you buy in the auto industry, when you buy a Ford and you buy it no matter where you buy it in the United States, you go to your Ford dealership and you get it serviced. The RV industry is not like that. You buy from that dealer, you get your warranty service from that dealer, and you go get it repaired from that dealer. One of the problems is that these folks have come up and targeted Oregon because of the loopholes in our laws, licensing, service requirements and defining what a show is. They've used those that loophole to travel around, sell, then go back home. Again, what we are trying to accomplish, not only protecting our Oregon businesses, but protecting the consumer. And the two things that the amendments, Dash 1 amendments, do, and I will go through those for you, is obviously further define the requirement on service facilities for new vehicles dealers only. Now, we have been contacted, obviously, by folks that do consignment and used dealerships that there was a problem in the printed bill. We acknowledge that problem. That was not the intent of the bill, is to apply across the board to service facilities. So you'll hear from someone following us regarding that. So what we've done, and I will point to that right away, on page 4 of the Dash 1 amendments, we do insert on line 5, new, and that's on page 2, line 16 of the printed bill, when we're requiring the applicant will offer the applicant will offer new recreational vehicles for sale, shall have this requirement on the service facility. Lines 15 through 18 of page 4 of the Dash 1 amendments also reiterate the emphasis on the selling of new recreational vehicles. And so I do want to make that point that we are putting that requirement upon ourselves, which our dealers do, and obviously a very important consumer protection item, we believe, for folks in the state who buy RVs. The second aspect of the bill is defining how RV dealers shall travel throughout the state. And what I mean by travel is a lot of folks do and sell RVs other than their place of business. And so they have a place of business. For instance, Roger here has a place of business here in Salem. If he wants to go up to Portland, he may do that. However, you under the bill require there's a minimum of 2 RV dealers. So it's very, very minimal. We're not saying, like in other states, that you have to have, for instance, in California, you have to have 10 dealers before you can travel and put on a show. We don't want to put ourselves in that much regulation. However, absent franchise laws, it's very important to put some kind of criteria around how you can travel throughout the state. And so what we've done is, if Roger wants to go to Portland or he wants to go to Eugene, he links up with an RV dealer, we'll put on a show. Well, what that does is it prohibits the person from Arizona or whoever in the United States who has targeted Oregon because they can come and do the traveling road shows from just conducting what they call a show. They advertise it as it is, as if it's a show. In fact, they're just doing business, and then they leave. The consumer obviously has a problem after that. The members of the association has uncovered these problems, because what they do is, when they go back to Arizona, they come back to the dealer and say, okay, I bought this this make of RV, I need it serviced now. And unfortunately, they're told that unless you bought it from them, that the service requirement, you're going to have to pay for it. So the bill defines the shows and how they shall travel. Now, as for the folks from Arizona, now, can they then come up and get a show license with another RV dealer? Yes, but it tightens it up enough where our folks know that these guys are frauds and that they are fly-by-nights. And so eventually, to go through just this little bit of regulation, we feel will knock those fly-by-nights out of the state and protect not only Oregon businesses but our consumers. And so I've brought Roger up here, and we do have several other RV dealers here today if there's any specific questions on the problem. But that's what obviously the intent of the bill. And again, I want to state finally that obviously the consignment dealers, the used dealers, had a problem with the facility requirement, and that it was not our intent to include those folks in. Only dealing with new dealers. And so, Mr. Chair, I'll open up the question.
So let me interrupt quickly. Dealers of used RVs are not included in this bill.
That's correct. The service facility requirement, used dealers and consignment dealers are not required under this bill to have a service facility.
Very good. Okay. Please continue.
I'll open up for questions, Mr.
Okay,
Chair.
Great. Representative Zahner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sean, isn't the whole problem the warranty problem when the guy buys a Winnebago or whatever and something happens and then if he repairs it at another dealer, the dealer is stuck with the price of that the manufacturer offers? Couldn't we solve this with the manufacturer straightening this thing out? Is that because I don't think you want to restrict business, because that's not what this thing's about, I hope. This is that the main problem?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, if I can have Roger ask, because he's in the field, I can ask.
Yeah, Chairman Starr, Representative Zahner. In a lot of cases, the dealer that came up from out of state may have bought distressed merchandise or obsolete merchandise.
Excuse me, can I just have you introduce yourself for the record?
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Roger Kirshner.
I'm
the owner of Highway Trailer Sales here in Salem, Oregon.
Thank you.
That they may have bought distressed or obsolete merchandise, could have still been new, maybe from a manufacturer that went bankrupt and was being represented as new merchandise. In the eyes of the consumer, that's what they were buying. When in fact when they ran into a problem with it and needed to have service done on it, they truly had no place to go. And that's one of the things that we're trying to prevent.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zahner, if I can state, we're here, this bill's not the intent to restrict business. You know, obviously, we feel a need to have these loopholes closed up. And obviously, for our business owners that are throughout the state to come together and recognize that there is a real problem here. You know, we're not trying to restrict business at all. And I know originally with the problem when used in consignment dealers on the service, you know, that has been stripped out and with the Dash 1 amendments, as I stated.
Representative Burgess?
Well, I'd first like to just say that I really think that you need to always protect your Oregon business people. They are the people that do business. They have a lot of requirements. They pay taxes. They live honorable lives or they're not in business. And I think that you need to do that. And I think that the consumer needs to be protected as well against people that come in that do not have to do those same requirements. There is a issue of fairness and being equitable here that I think needs to be addressed. I'm a little concerned about the two dealers, not putting a hardship on the RV dealer that might want to travel around, but also leaving it so open for out-of-state dealers to come in and just have one dealer, maybe one not-so-reputable dealer, that decides he will be the partner of California, Washington, and Arizona dealers that might want to come in for some kind of favoritism that might be offered to him. And also my other question is, what about business license when they come in? I'd like to know about that.
Ms. Chair, Representative Verger, if I can comment first, then Roger might have some comments. To address your first question on protecting or your comment on protecting Oregon businesses, and that is a fact that these folks come in, they go into the Walmart parking lots, they don't pay a lot of these taxes, and they take off. One of the reasons for the bill. When addressing the issue of, first of all, the business license, when they are going to first get their license, they are then on their certificate will have the location of their service facility. And the primary location will be for the service of RVs. And so that will be the first thing that they get when they get their license. What they've done before is they'll hang the sign on the used car dealership, and they'll say that will be their service facility. Well, not necessarily, because the primary purpose for that has been to service automobiles. And so the bill leaves open the fact for service facilities to be able to, if you contract with a RV service facility. So we're not saying that you have to have it on your dealership. It could be at another location. All we're saying is that has to be on the dealer certificate when you get your license, which will be new. And those are the legitimate dealers. And then the second thing, as for the show, last I'd like to address the two dealership requirement, because Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, that's something we have really, really worked on for the probably last year, and how we want to do that. Now, we picked two as a minimal, as a starting point. We started with five. Other states have a little bit more of a burden. Two, we feel, would obviously be a good start to see how the program's going to work, to see how when we require the service facility and we also require how are we going to travel throughout the state. And then obviously I think there might be room to look at that number again. There's even folks within my group that think it should be more. However, it's hard to pick and to increase that number at this point when we're creating a new program. We do feel, though, that the two requirement will stop the person from Arizona coming up or the person from other states. And so, you know, I understand your concern. For us, we feel that we're trying to do our best effort here as a starting point to try to restrict that. As to the right number, we're not sure yet, but it's a better starting point than where we are now. To address your supplemental license, because right now you can have a supplemental certificate. For instance, if Roger wants to have a supplemental certificate to, you know, within his to go less than 10 days at the Walmart parking lot, they still can do that. But this just tightens down how they're going to travel throughout the state. And my guess is if that person comes up from Arizona, legally gets a license, wants to be a legitimate dealer, and then travel around the state, he's not going to have any problems getting the two, which will be fine. He will be legitimate, that folks. It's the person that's not legitimate, which, believe me, these dealers know the fly-by-nights, and they're not going to want to be associated with a person that is ripping off the consumer, because that only hurts their businesses. And we don't want to be, our industry doesn't want to be painted in that light. And so that's obviously the thrust of the bill. And I think, you know, and obviously a good starting point.
Sure.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've had a little trouble picturing exactly how they pull off these shows. Do they hire a person for every single RV that has to be driven, and they display 50 RVs and do a 50 RV caravan with 50 drivers, something like this?
Yeah, Chair Starr, Representative Merkley, that's basically how they do it. These dealers that come up here from out of state have large inventories. The only way they can display those large inventories is to have them at public facilities. Just to use Volcano Stadium here in Salem as a, for instance, the Expo Center, Cortland Meadows. They have to have a spot where they can physically park 50 to 100 RVs. It's not easy to find those, and they do contract drivers to, you know, haul them from one location to the next. It's a big operation.
A follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just a little comment. I think there must be enormous expense in hiring 50 drivers to drive all the way from Arizona and drive back again for the ones they don't sell.
Yeah, Chair Starr, Representative Merkley, I don't know the exact numbers there, but I'm sure it costs a lot, but it doesn't cost as much as establishing a permanent place of business like legitimate RV dealers do. And, you know, their payroll expenses, insurance expenses, you know, for any of you here who are in business, I'm sure you're well aware of that.
Mr. Chair, additional question. How is a recreational vehicle defined in the law? Is it over a certain size? How do I distinguish that from other recreational?
Chair Starr, Representative Merkley, I'm not exactly sure how it's defined in the House bill.
Yeah, I don't have the actually.
We'll have ODOT staff have them come up after you're done to answer that question quickly.
So if I'm getting my hands around this, the problem is that I buy one of these RVs and the dealer's way off in Arizona, and maybe it had problems that weren't disclosed, and now the person who sold it is a long ways away. I can't get it down there for warranty service. There may not be anyone available nearby to work on it, or if they do, it may void the warranties. So essentially what we're insuring is that the consumer is not sold a bad product, a product that can't be supported. Does anything like this apply in the car business?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, absolutely. And one of the big differences, and I'll stress, in the car industry, they do have franchise agreements, franchise laws, something that is absent in the RV industry, which is the reason thrust of this bill. Again, you buy a Ford, you can go to any one of your Ford dealerships to get a service, because the agreement, when you sell a new auto, you know, a new Ford, let's say, you're going to service it. And that could, that consumer's protected under those franchise agreements. Without this, they're not.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you both very much for your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Monty King wants to comment on the bus, talking about used cars.
Used RV.
Used RV, used cars.
My name is Monty King, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Independent Auto Dealers Association. I don't come before you in support or against this bill, although I understand the reason for it. And Sean and Roger have told me that they are going to make sure that our used vehicle dealers are not going to be included under the bill, because we have a lot of dealers who... Oregon is kind of different because we have one dealer license. You can sell anything with that, basically. You go to Washington, you got to buy a retail license for cars and trucks. You got to buy a wholesale license. You got to buy a broker license. You got to buy an RV license. You got to buy a cycle license. You got to buy a boat license. Oregon, you can do it all. So we're pretty unique in that sense. My main comments, though, are the business regulation in Oregon is not really an even playing field anymore. Other states have tried to increase the evenness of their playing field, and the more they do that, the more our holes show up. And this is something that you are going to have to look at over the coming years. And the industry is part to blame for letting this happen, because we haven't come to you in an organized fashion, I think. Over the last few years, I know my association didn't do a lot, others didn't do a lot, but I think you're going to see a lot of things this session on the floor. Most of my bills are going to be our in commerce, smart growth and commerce bill, and we're going to have some of these things, but we're going to do a lot more over the coming years. You do have some problems here. There's AG questions. If they have a complaint, where do they go? Do they go to the Arizona AG, or do they go to our AG? That's a big issue, I think. If they buy on the internet and they get it delivered, who are they going to complain to? Park and sell lots, another big one. It's we have such a gaping hole in that area. It's amazing what's going to happen here. And it's like title loans. I mean, there's huge things with title loans going on. Nobody knows about it. We're going to bring it to you this session. Without a reasonable system of regulation, the consumers are going to get hurt, and Oregon business people are going to get hurt too, right along with them. And that's, I think, really what they're asking for is an even playing field, and we support that. At some point, we're going to have a look at the whole industry regulation scenario and see what's going on. Nobody's done it yet, and I think at some point you're going to have to. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Monty, any questions for Monty? They're jumping up and down up here. It's an honor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Wouldn't a franchise agreement, if the manufacturers of the trailers or RV things, if they had the same thing as the automobile dealers have, wouldn't that help solve the problem? I'm wondering why they don't have that.
Chairman Starr, Representative Zahner, RVs aren't like Fords and Chevys. There aren't, you got to remember how the auto industry got here. In 1903, in New England, there were 298 manufacturers of vehicles. How many are there now? None. Okay, so you've had a long history of how this stuff got together and why you have the big three now, or however many there are. RVs aren't like that. RVs are built in Wilsonville. They're built in Eugene. I mean, they're built in Woodburn. And they're distributed in a regional manner for the most part. I mean, there's some big ones, and Roger, let me know if I'm wrong on this, but it's not like cars where you make, I think new car production last year was 17.6 million. RVs aren't like that. They're individually, almost individually handcrafted. And, you know, if you really want to see what's going on, maybe go down to Marathon. Stop by there in Eugene, just on right on the freeway. Have you ever seen those buses there?
Yeah.
You know how much those start out at? Base price? $500,000. It's just the bus, right? But I've been in some of those. They're $1.25 million, just sitting there. I mean, it's not like cars. And it's never going to be like cars. And that's why you're going to have these regional scenarios of people trying to come in and you know, try and get money out of people and not provide what's reasonable and what's promised.
Thank you.
Representative Merkley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, if the RFEs are manufactured multitudinous locations around the country, multitudinous brands, I get from what you're saying, there's hundreds of RV brands. Would the bill, as it's constructed now, really narrow the choice for Oregon consumers to just a handful of brands out of the hundreds that are being offered around the country?
Representative Chairman Starr, Representative Merkley, I don't believe so, because they have the ability to come in and get a dealer's license and have a location here just like everybody else. You know, our association is an instructor of classes for people to get licenses, so I know the rules pretty well. There's nothing that stops them from coming in, getting an Oregon license, and having a building and doing what they're supposed to be doing. Now, it's going to cost them a couple $1,000, but that's not very much to start a business, especially when we're talking RVs. I mean, if I had to put a figure on a stock of a normal RV place, we're talking millions. And it's not always the dealer stuff. It's flooring and financing. I mean, they don't own it all, but it's like a Dodge or a Chevy store. You're going to have millions invested in there. But they have the ability to do that. But we have really loose DMV laws. It's not DMV's fault. It's the industry fault, basically, because we didn't come and try and work with you and try and get this, as other states develop their regulation and reasonableness. We haven't done that. So that's kind of what you're seeing with this. This is one of the probably 8 or 9 things you're going to see this session. But it's hard to get us. One out of every 7 jobs is automotive related.
If our manufacturers from Wilsonville and so forth wish to go and sell in another state, are they currently pretty well prohibited from doing so by the restrictions that are in California or in Washington?
Chairman Starr, Representative Merkley, not to my knowledge. I work with the California, Washington. I belong to a group of 35 people like me. I have never, ever heard of anything that would stop one of our new RV dealers from going and starting a business in any other state, unless they were currently revoked or suspended in Oregon.
But does the requirement to have a service facility in the other state make it impractical?
Representative Starr, Representative Merkley, I do not know that. I do know that I have seen new car dealer licensing boards and stuff in other states where their manuals are this thick. But I do not know what the recreational industry done. I think they're fairly new at this and trying to figure out what's happening with their industry.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Monty, for your testimony. I'd like to have Marvin Houston come up. Thank you very much for coming to Salem. You came a distance this morning.
I did. Thank you for having me.
The effort.
My name is Marvin Houston, and I'm from Winston, which is a little bit south of Roseburg, for those of you that don't know. I'm new at this, and I apologize up front if I don't address you properly.
You're doing fine.
Okay. Chairman Starr and the committee, I brought a letter that my wife and I drafted over the last couple of weeks after we became aware of this House bill. We, for 15 years, have been self-employed. We sell on consignment recreation vehicles for folks like yourselves. In our community, there's a lot of senior citizens, a lot of people that have relocated into the area and think they'll never go camping again, so they bring us their RVs, and we help them sell them, and then about 18 months later, they get the itch to go camping again, and they come looking for another RV. So we fill a real special little niche there, and we enjoy doing what we do. I'd like to read this letter to you. We've been in the RV consignment business for nearly 15 years. For the last 13 years, we have not had a maintenance repair facility for recreation vehicles. We use the services of several competent, licensed, and insured RV technicians that are mobile and come to our lot to make repairs. This has worked very nicely for us. We choose not to be in the RV service business for several reasons, including the following. Insurance could cost us over $7,000 per year in premiums. Perhaps it's more than that by now, and it's very difficult to obtain if you don't already have it. Building and equipping a repair facility is very cost prohibitive for us and for other small business people, I'm sure. We would be required to have licensed propane technicians on duty if we're going to do repair work to propane appliances. We would also be required, just by the nature of the maintenance facility, to stock and inventory parts and supplies. We would have an entirely new set of books to keep. Currently, my wife is my bookkeeper, and she's plenty burdened with that alone. And she's not excited at all about having to maintain another set of books for a repair facility. And the time and energy involved in starting and maintaining the service business. House Bill 2565's proposed amendments seem to exempt those selling used RVs and require only dealers selling new RVs to comply with the required maintenance facility. This would take care of our situation as it is today. However, we have considered several times over the years to take on lines of new RVs. And for your information, an RV, 15 years of selling used RVs, tent trailers, campers, slide-in pickup campers, you know, small units are still considered RVs. So when we're talking taking on a line of new RVs under this proposal, taking on the smallest line of an RV would require us to maintain and a repair facility. We have been approached by several different manufacturers. Last spring, for instance, I talked with Thor, and they were quite comfortable if we would take on a line of their new equipment to deal with our mobile service people that come to our facility. In other words, they're not requesting us to maintain a repair facility. House Bill 2565 would force us to create a new business that we do not want to be in. Our choice would be taken away. We don't believe that's fair. We don't believe that's right. Our government should not have the power to force a small business owner to start another business that business owner does not need and does not want to be in. According to the summary, House Bill 2565 was sponsored by the Oregon Recreation Vehicle Dealers Association, a group representing Oregon RV dealers. My wife and I called 6 dealers from Grants Pass to Eugene. None of them had heard of House Bill 2565. I even called the vice president of the ORVDA, and he had not a clue about this bill until I brought it to his attention. The Oregon Recreation Vehicle Dealers Association, by name and by sponsorship of this bill, would have you believe that they represent the best interests of Oregon RV dealers. The Oregon RV Dealers Association doesn't represent my best interest. We feel the bill would do harm to small business and that it should not become law. If you have any questions, I have some other comments, but if you want to have some questions first.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah. I think we got some questions. Jefferson Crubb?
Thank you. Marvin, is it your opinion that if you sell a new RV, that
someone should be available to service and do the warranty work on that product?
I believe that there should be service available. Using that scenario, when I was listening to the other comments made earlier, if a person buys an RV from one of the dealers here in Salem and encounters a problem in Texas, he's going to have the same situation as a person that bought the RV here from a dealer that went away after the transaction was made. So if this scenario plays out every day, all summer long, year round, people that have RVs with warranties that find themselves far and away from the dealer that they purchased it from with service and warranty problems.
Okay, so Mr. Chair, if I may.
Yeah, go ahead.
So do you consider it to be an accepted industry practice that dealers who sell new products offer service and warranty work because so many of their clients are local folks that come and buy from them and want to come back and make sure that service and warranty work done? Is that your understanding, that that's how the industry normally works?
I would say so. I would say that, you know, new dealers that in our area, in the Roseburg area, Douglas County, there's three or four new dealers, and to one degree or another, they offer service, parts, accessories. But I would think that ought to be left up to them to do that. If they choose to get out of that portion of their business, they ought to be able to do that. I don't have a problem with that at all.
Okay. You're just saying, Mr. Chair, if I might, you're just saying that you're making a choice that if you decided to sell new vehicles, mm-hmm. that you don't want to be involved in the service business for any reason. But that you think, if I'm trying to hear you correctly, that you think that if you did sell a new vehicle, that they ought to have service somewhere locally?
Well, what I'm saying, rather than have you put words in my mouth, what I'm saying is I feel like I should have the choice whether I want to have a service facility. If I choose to sell new equipment and I approach a manufacturer and say, I'd like to sell your trailers, your campers, et cetera, and they say, well, we insist that you have an on-site service facility, I may opt not to take that line of equipment on. I may go on to another manufacturer that will allow me to use a competent mobile service or contract with another dealer in town that would be happy to have my service business.
Thank you, Merkley. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm envisioning that these RVs are largely constructed on an existing frame, a board frame, a truck frame, a Chevy train. Is that right?
Yeah, Representative Merkley, that is correct when we're speaking of the motorized RVs. And the term recreation vehicle covers folding trailers that you crank up, slide the ends out, includes campers that slide in and pick up, fifth wheels, trailers, motorhomes. But the motorized versions, yes, they're on a standard chassis that parts are available anywhere. A service, if it's a Chevrolet chassis that has a problem, it generally would go to a Chevy garage if it's a serious problem.
Yeah. Since people are driving their RVs all over the countryside, I'm assuming that some practice has emerged of a way for people to get their RVs repaired when on the road. I'm assuming that's related for the powertrain to the fact that those that have engines, if you will, they can go to a Chevy, somebody who knows Chevys or somebody who knows Fords and so forth. And then we have these other issues that arise. Your toilet doesn't flush right or something of that nature. Do these require a lot of specialized parts to repair? Or is this sort of like repairing a house where you go to somebody who knows how to repair your plumbing, they're going to be able to fix the thing?
Representative Merkley, to answer that question, there are the components of the recreation vehicle are pretty generic. There's two or three brands of refrigerators that you'll find in the $500,000 motorhomes that he mentioned earlier. Probably the same refrigerator or manufacturer of that refrigerator will be in the very least expensive of pickup camper. So, and there are warranties that come with new equipment on the components. So it's not a situation where just because you bought the RV brand new in Roseburg and you have refrigerator trouble in Las Cruces, New Mexico, you can find a refrigerator repair person of that brand that will warranty that work.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Since you're selling these on a lot of RVs on consignment, do you have, I'm assuming that a lot of these, as you prep them for sale, that you have to call in repairmen and get different components repaired, and is it your experience that you do not have difficulty getting those repaired, even if they're an out-of-state RV?
I have absolutely no problem with that, Representative Merkley. We have been selling old used RVs and some very, very late model used RVs over the last 15 years. We've sold 2001 models in the year 2000. People have bought them, changed their mind, decided to have us sell them. We've encountered problems with some of the very latest RVs, and I have not had a problem yet that I could not call a mobile technician to come in and solve that problem.
Well, one last question, Mr. Chair. You're not in the show business. You don't go and put on shows around the state.
Correct.
You're out of an established site here in Oregon, and your customers, you don't have a list of complaints that have been filed. Your customers feel like they can get their problems solved when they need to have them solved.
Representative Merkley, yes, that's absolutely correct. I don't have a desire to do shows. At one time, 11 or 12 years ago, we went to the mall, the local mall. They had a sportsman show, and we took two or three traders in. But no, we're not in the show circuit business. I will tell you, however, any time there's been a show at our fairgrounds, whether it be Romania from Eugene or people from the South, it has generated a lot of excitement about RVs in general. And I have actually noticed a spike in traffic on my lot. And so I honestly can't. And I'm sure I probably missed some deals to those guys, but I'm also pretty sure that it probably has brought some business out and brought people out of their homes out to look at the product. And we've been there long enough in our business and in our location that if a local wakes up tomorrow and says, let's go look at RVs, they're going to come to our place to look at RVs. They're not going to go, unless they're a complete impulse buyer, they're probably not going to go to anybody's lot and buy on their first visit.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Houston, explain to me a little bit about your business. Do you have a consignment lot that people bring you the vehicles, the used vehicles, and you sell them for them? Is some of the inventory your inventory? Is it all used? I'm not real sure of exactly where you are.
Representative Verger and members of the committee, that's a very good question, because a lot of people don't have a clue what consignment is, and I didn't either until 15 years ago. The way we do our business is, yesterday was a typical example. Early senior citizen couple came in. They have a 37-foot motorhome. He's losing his vision. They've owned the motorhome about 5 years. And through word of mouth and a good reputation, they walked into my office and said, are you Marvin? And I said, yeah. And he said, okay, we're in the right place. And they sat down, and we chatted about their motorhome and the value of it. I subscribed to Kelley Blue Book, so we were able to establish a fair value that they could live with and that we could still make our commission, which is 10% of the sale price, incidentally. We establish a price that they can live with, that we feel we can get our commission over and above that. And if they decide they want us to consign it and go to work for them, generally, in a case like that, the lady will pick me up some morning, take me to their home, and I'll drive the motorhome back in for them because of the vision situation. And that's not an unusual situation for us. We're very one-on-one. It's a small business. We average about 50 units in inventory. Any given month, you can come out and count between 45 and 50 consigned RVs. Typically, we'll own maybe two or three of those, and that's only by taking it in trade. In other words, if my 10% commission on a $30,000 deal is just $3,000, and instead someone wants to offer us a trade in and $27,000, okay, we may take the trade and clean it up and resell it, and that would be our commission. So if and when we own any equipment, it's through trade-ins. It's not necessarily from going out and purchasing.
Follow-up, please. And you do not have employees?
Representative Virgie, that's not necessarily 100% accurate. We employ our son. He's 17. He works part-time for us. Son is a lot boy in,
right.
in cleaning. We use private contractors to do our cleaning. They come through and vacuum, wipe out refrigerators, et cetera. And then we also use the RV technicians who are licensed and insured and bonded.
So your investment actually is providing the lot where the RVs are parked, and you own that property. But other than just two or three trade-ins, that is that pretty much the limit of your investment in the business?
Representative Verger, that is partly right. We have a tremendous investment in over the last 15 years in our time and our building. We do lease the property that we're on. And we maintain the building. It looks very nice. We have, you know, all the equipment that we need to do our business every day. We own it. It is a minimal investment as far as being in the RV business. However, you need to know that most new equipment you see on a sales lot is floored. It doesn't mean the owner of that business necessarily has paid his own money out and purchased that equipment. He's responsible for it, but doesn't necessarily own it.
What is your concern about this bill since it exempts used vehicles?
Representative Verger, this bill concerns me because it would force me, unless I wanted to break the law, it would force me to have a full-service shop in the event that I decide at a later date to take on a line of new RVs.
One more question. Would a company allow you to sell new vehicles without going through any kind of a certain requirements, the size of the lot, the size of the building? Would you then fall under a lot of other regulations and requirements, or could you just take on a line of new RVs?
Representative Verger, the rules and requirements in that situation you just described are pretty loose. There are manufacturers that would love to have us as a dealer to have their new equipment on our lot, but some of them do require a service facility on site. There are others, one that I contacted last spring, that I told them right up front that I do not intend to have a technician on duty. I don't want to be in that business. Mm-hmm. And they said that as long as I had a technician available that could handle the pre-delivery inspections to make sure everything works in the vehicle, and that we had someone available to handle warranty problems, which, let's just say that you purchased a new trailer from me and I didn't have a repair facility, and you bring it back because it has a bad water heater, then I would call South County RV, a company that I deal with. They would come up, solve the problem, I would pay them, and then this manufacturer would reimburse me for the repair. And so, theoretically, new vehicles shouldn't have a lot of service problems.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Anything else? Thank you very much for your...
I had some other comments.
Oh, please.
Right, you have time.
Yeah.
Okay. I made some notes. One comment I wanted to make was that I really don't have a problem with parts of this bill. I don't have a problem with restricting out-of-state dealers coming into the area. I'm not opposed to the show portion of this bill. I do want to repeat myself, if I could, and that is the scenario that someone brings an RV into the community and sells it, disappears, and there's a service problem, is no bigger problem than someone that buys that RV from an established dealer and has a problem out of town while they're vacationing with the rig. And I also want to mention that I've done some investigative work myself on this, and the dealers that come to town from out of state do generate a few complaints from the customers that are handled through DMV. but they're not tremendous. There's not a lot of complaints made to DMV. Problems with used RVs are generally with components, like she mentioned, toilet, water heater, furnace, and the like, and those are pretty generic. Parts are available, and most service people can take care of those. And a lot of the traveling shows they mentioned they bring up a lot of used tired equipment. Most of those don't come with warranties anyway. None of the used equipment that I sell has warranties. Another point I would like to make is that any RV that gets sold in your community, whether it be by a local established dealer or someone traveling through town, just the fact that there is another RV owned by a member of the community means there's more fuel being purchased, there's service going to be done when it needs to be done, there's parts going to be purchased, and so it doesn't take all of the business, all of the fun out of having missed that deal. There's still money to be made off of that RV that's been sold. And my feeling is that a lot of sales that are made at shows are compulsive purchases that customer probably wouldn't have gone out and made that purchase locally. I remember buying a car one time, wondering as I drove away, and how did that happen? Anyway, I really want to tell you again, I appreciate the opportunity to be here today, and thank you guys for being here, and I wished a little more respect was given to you in the quietness and even coming in and out of the building while you're doing your business here.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I have one question. Thank you. For Marvin. What if this new bill exempts dealers like yourself that were already in business in the state of Oregon so that you did have a choice? For instance, if it grandfathered you in, so if you did want to pick up a new line and didn't have to build the shop, how would you feel about the building?
Well, Representative Zahner, that I appreciate that question because I've thought about that, and I don't know, as my kids get older, I think a little bit more about their well-being and what they may want to do and the choices they may have, and I would certainly hate to see a restriction placed on someone from my family or yours that wanted to open a business, reputable business like I have, and be restricted from selling new equipment. It's a tremendous expense to set up a shop. So I guess to answer your question, the grandfather issue that you bring up, I don't have a problem. That would be fine. But the next guy that comes along that wants to open up and do the same type of business I do should not be forced to have a shop. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Thank you. We've got one more here.
Thank you. Mr. Chair Marvin, just one last question for you. You mentioned that you do have people readily available that you bring in to do repairs on your lot. And are they independent contractors?
Yes, Representative Rosenbaum, they are. They're licensed. They're well-educated in their line of work. Last week, one of the technicians that I use went to Portland to do some training in some awning installations. He's been to several out-of-town ongoing education for air conditioning, heating, and that type. They're very, very confident people.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Do these independent contractors work exclusively sort of coming to facilities like yours, or do they also work in some of these permanent maintenance facilities? I'm not familiar with how those are staffed.
Representative Rosenbaum, I appreciate that question. That's a good one. There are two gentlemen in our area that I use rather regularly that work out of their home. Okay. And they don't have a facility big enough to put a trailer in or a camper in to work on it. The third company that I use has a very, very nice shop, and anytime I have a project that he doesn't want to do outdoors, he will either take it to a shop or I take it to him, and when he's done with the work, I go get it. And I get several calls a week, or drop-ins even, asking if we do service, and because we don't, I'll refer them to the technician that I think could best help them. There's one fellow in town that has a nice little shop, but he hasn't kept up on the latest in electronics and the latest in technology and RVs, and they have made great strides over the last 10 years. And his name is Larry. So the stuff that isn't real technical, I just send them down the street to see Larry. Now, if they have other problems or a late model rig with problems, then there's other people that I would try to turn them to best take care of their problem. Does that answer your question?
Just one final follow-up. I guess what I'm trying to get at, though, is there a different workforce of people who work for the new RV dealers who maintain their own maintenance facilities, or is there some overlap between the sort of technicians that you're using and sending people to and the people that work there?
Well,
would you ever send people to one of the new RV dealers?
Oh, yes, ma'am. Yes, I do. Mm-hmm.
Does that answer that question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Are you done now?
I have all day.
I appreciate your effort coming to Salem, spending probably nearly the whole day coming up to provide us with good information. It's kind of unique that we have somebody that'll come, you know, several hours drive to Salem to testify. So
I appreciate
your
saying that. Could I have a follow-up?
Certainly. Absolutely.
I was talking to my 17-year-old son last night. He'd finished up his homework, and he came into the dining room where I was putting the final touches on this letter. And I said, you know, Nick, I said, this is really a good lesson for us all. I said, here's a small group of individuals who claim to represent a large group of individuals. And this could come to pass to be a law. This could actually become a law. And the reality of it is there's probably only half a dozen people that are revved up about this. And I hope the reality is that it doesn't take many of us to stop the process if it's a bad proposition. And I would invite any of you to give me a call. Our phone number's on the letter if I can answer any of the questions for you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
I'd like to have Kelly Taylor.
Mr. Chairman, maybe we do need to explain that we don't make the final decision. It has to go to a larger vote.
Right.
Mr. Chair,
multi-step process.
I also would like, Mr. Chair, in regards to Mr. Husing's parting comment, I'd like to have Sean Miller come forward and address that issue. I was in a meeting some time ago with six RV dealers.
Hang tight. Sean will come up in a minute.
Okay. These dealers were all across the state. Mm-hmm. I have spent years in this business at various levels. And I disagree with many of Mr. Houston's comments. I am disturbed that there's an allegation that the industry, the state organization, is not doing their job in talking with their dealers. And I'd like some response to that. That's not my impression in any way. And if I thought it was, I wouldn't be a party to this legislation. So I'd like some response there.
Yeah, I appreciate those comments. And, yeah, I intend to have Sean come up. But we'll like to have Kelly address the regulatory issues in the bill and answer any There's no computer upgrade cost.
There's no computer upgrade. I'm
leaving the room. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Taylor at the Department of Transportation. And no, I don't believe there's any computer upgrade on this particular bill. We're still looking. We got the amendments yesterday. We're still looking at them. And we'll continue to work with Sean as the bill goes through. If it goes through. I wanted to answer the question. Somebody wanted to know what the definition of recreational vehicle was or is, and so I went and got it real quick. It's a vehicle with or without motive power designed for human occupancy, used temporarily for recreational, seasonal, or emergency purposes. So that's the definition of recreational vehicle. We have been working with Sean. I've been aware of the concern on this issue for some time. During the interim, Mr. Kirshner had contacted us, and we had looked into it and told him that at this point, everybody was doing everything that was according to statute, and there was no violations or anything, you know, that we saw wrong, and that, you know, a service facility is not part of the current statute, and that would take a law change, and hence this bill. And I've looked at the amendments, and I've been trying to mark up the bill with the amendments to try to see. It's always tough when you've got a bill and amendments, and you're trying to see how they weave together. And it does look like it addresses the concern that Monty King raised, and that is, with these amendments, it will affect only new recreational vehicle dealers. It will not affect used or consignment or anything like that. Only the brand new recreational vehicles. I'm not real familiar with the show license sort of thing. I haven't looked at other laws, other states to see what that is. I'm not sure what kind of a workload that will be. I will tell you that the amendments allow us to establish an appropriate fee for those show licenses, and that would be good because I don't believe this would be something I could spend highway fund dollars on. As we go through this, if this really came to be, we'd have to establish what the cost is, and the fee would have to cover all of the costs associated with this. But I don't know that there would be, I don't know how many of these it will be. We're still doing research on that.
How long will that take to before you might know?
I don't even know if we will be able to find out how many shows would fall under these guidelines. We're going to probably just have to estimate it. I don't think it's going to equal an FTE or anything like that, Mr. Chair.
My hesitancy would be to pick a number out of midair, or just to allow DMV to set the amount without legislative approval.
Right. Well, Mr. Chair, I would say that since this is giving us to do the rules, then there's a bill that was passed in the 95 session, Senate Bill 333, which stays in statute that any fee that is changed or established by rule during the interim must be brought forth in a bill and blessed by Ways and Means in the next session. So even if we do something in the interim, the next session and Ways and Means will have to bless that fee. So, and that was done from before. So that's kind of the safety net there for rules by fee, or fees by rule, sorry.
Any questions? Mr. Berger has a question.
Kelly, I'd like to address something that Monty King brought up, and that is when a person has a problem, which AG do they go to? In Oregon, if you're doing business in Oregon, make a sale in Oregon, and that person has a problem with that sale, isn't it a natural that it goes to the Oregon Attorney General?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, I do know that there is a fraud investigation unit and some things like that with Department of Justice that people can go to lemon laws and things like that. And if it were an Oregon sale, I would imagine they would start with the Oregon Department of Justice.
If it was a legitimate sale made within the state of Oregon.
Mr. Chair and Representative Berger, that would be my understanding, yes.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Merkley?
The definition of RV that you read concludes as further defined by rule. If I put a camper on my truck, is my truck now a recreational vehicle, or is the camper a recreational vehicle?
Mr. Chair and Representative Merkley, your truck still stays a pickup truck and has its own registration, and the housing unit that you put on the back, that the camper has its own licensing.
Is it a recreational vehicle as construed in this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, it has a camper plate on it. I would imagine it may fit the definition of recreational vehicle, but under Oregon statute, it would have a camper plate on it. There's different plates. There's different registration.
Mr. Chair, as currently this bill is further defined by rule by the director, so I assume there's some details, but would this bill affect campers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, I'd have to look at that to see if it does. I think that there's a definition of recreational vehicle that is used for some statutes, and then there's camper for registration. So, it probably fits for dealers. It's probably going to fit under recreational vehicles.
How about tent trailers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, I would imagine the same thing.
Okay. Additional question, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. If I decide and I want to check out all the manufacturers in the U.S. and buy an RV, and I find an RV manufactured in Montana that has the type of chassis I want, so on and so forth, so I'm basically buying it over the Internet, I'm buying it over a web page, would this bill in any way affect that, or would that person have to become licensed in Oregon for me to purchase the vehicle over the internet?
Mr. Chair, members of Merkley, I don't believe this bill will affect that because that dealer isn't licensed here any more than you can buy a car from Idaho and bring it into Oregon. Mm-hmm. It isn't where you live and where you're buying it from, per se, where it's being sold from.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Thanks, Kelly. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Your testimony. You're welcome.
John, if you want to come back, I've got a question that I'd like you to deal with before you deal with what Representative Krepp brought up. Really, I think we've come to agreement on most of the bill. There's still the question of Mr. Houston brought forward a gentleman or a person engaged in business now, you know, selling used or on consignment RV vehicles, at some point, you know, signing a contract with a new dealer. Would it be possible to further amend the bill, agreeable to you, I guess, this might be a better term, where we would allow them to do that if they had some kind of agreement worked out with somebody that would service the vehicles that they sold? Clearly, Mr. Houston does at this point. We just included that kind of as a in the statute?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller, again with the Oregon Recreational Vehicle Dealers Association. To answer your question, you know, we believe, obviously, the intent of requiring service on new dealers. Again, I want to state, he talked about some of the expenses being of requiring a new service facility. The amendments do write his particular business, selling used and consignment, out of that requirement. Mm-hmm. But to allow him, if he wanted to sell new vehicles, obviously we'd want them to be able to service those for the consumer, play under the same rules as every other new dealership in the state, and which most manufacturers require anyway. To have an agreement with a service facility, we believe we've written the law vague enough. If they're going to require or have service on that particular RV that's new, then that's available under the law.
Under the amendments?
Under the amendments, the dash one amendments. It talks about, now when you define on section one, sub one, service facility means a permanent facility, on the dealer certificate, having the primary purpose of servicing recreational vehicles. So if he signs a contract on his lot to sell new vehicles, great. And he, on that dealer certificate, has an agreement or works out and has a repair facility, as long as it's listed on the dealer certificate, then that's a guarantee for the consumer who then comes into that lot and buys that new dealer to have it serviced. And that agreement is, is the intent of the bill.
So the dealer, the service facility would not have to necessarily be on the dealer's lot or the dealer's premises.
Ms. Chair, and actually the reason we wrote it this way is because some don't. Robertson here in town, if you go down Highway 22, Robertson has their dealership that sells RVs. Well, on State Street, they have their RV service facility set up to service the Robertson RVs. And so under that scenario, on the dealer certificate and on the sign, because they're going to require to have the place of business and where they service the vehicle, the consumer comes in and buys, their service warranty is going to be serviced there at the Robertson.
There would be no restriction, perhaps, that a dealer may have three or four different subcontractors, well, that would service their sales. There would be no requirement that they couldn't list them all.
Mr. Chair, I believe that's correct. And again, you just look at the broad definition, and I believe this is obviously something we work out the details and the rules, but the intent is, as long as you're getting a guarantee on your certificate that you have the service facility, then that means he would be playing under the same rules as a new dealership. The consumer would be protected, and we would be guaranteeing service on those vehicles.
Any other questions from the committee?
Yep.
I got
Mr. Chair.
What if his service facility was in Arizona?
Well, Mr. Chair,
has to do is display it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zahner, it has to be on your certificate in the state, so you'll have to state on the certificate.
Okay. What if he said it was in Arizona? Tempe, Arizona.
Kelly?
Yeah.
Can you come up, please?
Good question.
I get nervous when you're back there shaking your head.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kelly Taylor again. It doesn't say the facility is located in Oregon, Representative Zahner, you're correct.
But can we just write that in?
Sure.
Follow up then.
Yeah,
I guess my question is, an Arizona dealer could come in, or anybody, and as long as it said on a certificate wherever their service place was, which no one's going to pay any attention to anyway when they're buying a new rig. I mean, they're not worried about it. So it seems they could still do what they're doing, I guess is what I'm saying, unless you close that loophole.
Well, Representative Zahner, I'll tell you as a salesman in this business that Mama doesn't care where the service facility is, but Daddy does.
Okay. Okay.
Leave me.
I was just curious. I'm wrong in saying it.
Hey, Representative Verger?
The purchaser. Another problem with that particular thing, that as long as you put on there where that service facility is, Sean, I think it's different where it's Robertson's service facility, where you have a person working out of their home. I think the idea is you're trying to raise the standards for this industry.
Absolutely.
And if you're going to just say you can just name anybody at, you know, Pine Street is going to be it, I think you've really done some harm to the standards that you're trying to set for the industry. And I think that if it's a very nice service facility, then that's a whole different thing. But I would be questioning the standards.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you. I guess Sean or Kelly, because my question is sort of along the same line of the distinction that Representative Richard just made. What would prevent the facility from being one of the independent contractors, because it sounds like a lot of this work is done by independent contractors right now who do maintain facilities, whether they're at their home or just, you know, they rent a space somewhere, so they've got an adequate sized facility to house the vehicle and do the work.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, on page 4 of the -1 amendments, lines 15 through 18, again, that reemphasize the sale of new RVs for sale, certifies that the dealer maintains a RV service facility as listed on the dealer certificate. So obviously, you look at the definition on the first page, it's a permanent facility. They have to maintain that facility for the use of servicing recreational vehicles. I believe that clarifies the question.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. So that seems to actually be stating, now that I look at that language, that it is the dealer that has to maintain the facility.
Right.
So you really couldn't have the scenario where the dealer is contracting with somebody else who then is doing the repair work. That isn't clear looking at the
how I read it,
the first
that's
page.
That's exactly how I read it.
Two together,
Rosenbaum, exactly.
It has to be a permanent facility maintained by the dealer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Rogers. Mr. Kirshner?
Yeah, Chair Starr, members of the committee, in particular Representative Verger, I think you brought up some real good comments about the responsibility of a dealer, to bring up their standards. It certainly wasn't our intention here today to step on the foot of Marvin in particular, or anybody that wants to conduct a business the way he is. He's been in business for 15 years. Obviously, he's a responsible businessman. It's certainly not our intention to hurt anyone that's doing business in a responsible manner. He's found his niche, you know, selling used vehicles, and he's right, the responsibility on the dealer's part isn't the same when you're selling a used unit. But if you're going to step into the arena of selling new recreational vehicles, I think a dealer needs to make a commitment to service that vehicle. I just think it's a fiduciary responsibility. If he chooses not to get into that niche, that's his choice. But I think if you look at any successful recreational vehicle dealer in the state, they've made that commitment to a service department. The ones that have not made that commitment aren't here today. And that's, you know, if you look at the guys that were doing business 10 years ago that didn't have service departments selling new recreational vehicles, most of them are not here today. The ones that made the commitment are, you know, that's really, you know, really the difference. I think Sean brought up a good point on Mike Robertson's place here in town. He has a service facility at a different location, but it has his name on the sign. It's his business, and he's there to provide service to the people that do business with him and to other people, you know, when they have time. And I personally think that's the way it should be, and I think many of the dealers in my organization feel that's the way it should be, that you shouldn't be contracting out to other people. You should make the commitment yourself to service what you sell if you're dealing in new merchandise. That's just part of it. And I think that alone would keep dealers coming in here from out of state. If they feel they can come in here without making that commitment and sell new vehicles, they're sure going to try it. I think this would stop them, while not hurting businesses that want to do businesses legitimately within the state. If I may make one other comment, Chair Stark, Representative Krupp, in regard to some of our members not being informed on what was going on. They may not have been at the time Marvin talked to them, but they all have copies of the House bill. The Vice President may not have been informed about it because he wasn't on the legislative committee. We had a half a dozen dealers involved on the committee in a serious manner. They all know. There's three dealers here today, you know, that aren't on the committee that are aware of the bill and support it. There's many dealers here in the state that I know support the bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, to answer that question further. The association represents approximately 40 dealers, new recreational vehicles statewide. It's a new association formed early last year, so they are obviously building. Like any association, you have legislative committees that handle the issues. This was the main issue why they actually formed the association. The reason they formed is because they realized that not only they were in trouble, but the consumer was. So that's the intent of them forming. The members of the committee are from Grants Pass, Medford, Portland, Eugene, Bend. We cover rural Oregon, urban Oregon, a broad section. And as for the one, you know, the individual that saying that this is just a small group of people trying to change the laws to affect them, I want to say that it isn't. It's something that we have been working on, and our intent is not to to hurt Marvin at all. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair. Representative Griffin. It appears like the bill as written would affect tent trailers and campers. Maybe it would even affect canopies if they're large enough.
Mm-hmm.
Is this the intention of the, not canopies, just campers? Okay. Do you want to narrow this to just being what we normally think of as RVs, just the big fifth wheels and the self-propelled recreational vehicles?
Yeah, Chair Starr, Representative Merkley, I know when somebody says RV or recreational vehicle, the first thing that comes to mind is motorhome. But to people that are in the industry, RV covers a whole gambit of towable type trailers, travel trailers, fifth wheels. They go anywhere in length from 16 feet to 40 feet in length. Tent trailers, certainly a form of recreational vehicle. It's a unit you can take out and sleep in, go camping in, you can cook in it, there's water in it. Truck camper, you know, that's in the industry is considered to be a recreational vehicle. If you haven't looked at one for a while, you might be amazed at the equipment that comes on a truck camper. We sell them at our dealership, and we say it's a truck camper that thinks it's a motorhome. They come with onboard generators, air conditioners, microwaves. It meets the IRS's description of a home. You can use it as a tax write-off. So it's, you know, it's not the same type of camping unit that you may equate with of 20 years ago. Those are all considered forms of recreational vehicles. A canopy would not, because there's no facilities in it. All it is a cover over the box of your pickup truck.
Representative Krupp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sean, do you think that if you make an amendment to your amendments that allow some of a type of service facility, such as mobile service, do you gut the real consumer protection issue here in terms of protecting consumers from out-of-state dealers who come in and don't offer any service?
Could you state that one more time, please, Representative?
If you made an amendment here to your amendments that says it isn't a permanent facility, but service means contracting out with a mobile service tech, does that gut, in your opinion, the intent of the bill, which is to use the service provision as the consumer protection issue here? Because that's really what's going on. Fly-by-nighters are coming into town, and they're not offering service, and people are getting hurt.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, I think there's two ways to look at that. I think if you keep the definitions as is, contract on a permanent facility where the primary use is for RVs. Now, remember, they were using primary facilities used to be for used car dealerships. I think then there's ways that we can work contract in. I would have to obviously talk, and we'd have to discuss that issue. However, on the if you keep changing the definitions to require an independent person that might work at home, that definitely guts the intent of the bill and the consumer, that, and the most important consumer protection part of the bill.
So Mr. Chair, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
So then, if I'm hearing you correctly, one of your key thoughts as to putting the words permanent facility in the bill and in the amendments is that is the criteria, the standard that Representative Verger was talking about earlier, that we're trying to raise to, that makes it illogical for an out-of-state dealer to come in here with the intent of just doing a quick sale and beating feet out of town. Yet, if an out-of-state dealer wants to come in and make that commitment, they would have to meet this standard, and thereby ensuring that new owners of new RVs are going to be properly serviced and maintained.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, you're absolutely right. And again, I'll emphasize only new RV dealers.
Thank you.
How many manufacturers or how many brands are there of motor homes, not tent trailers in the country?
Chairman Starr, Representative Merkley, I really don't know. I've been in the business for 27 years, but there's got to be, you know, currently in production, different manufacturing locations throughout the nation, there's got to be probably, you know, 40 or 50 different manufacturers. And within those lines, they have sublines, different price ranges. And
that's enough. So of those 50 brands, if we pass this bill, how many of them do we anticipate a consumer would have access to within Oregon?
Most all. Now, Representative Starr, Representative Merkley, there again, I'm not really sure, but you know, each of those manufacturers, they will choose dealers in various locations throughout the nation, and it would just be a matter of, you know, what dealers felt that they could use that product.
You don't have a ballpark estimate?
Of how many of them are offered for sale here in the state, I'd say probably at least half or two-thirds of them.
But, Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, the bill is not the intent to carve those manufacturers out at all, and not to inhibit their ability to use the dealers. We don't believe the bill will affect that in nature.
Let me ask one last question here, and I'll ask my thoughts. what's to prevent the folks from Arizona from, under this bill, what's to prevent them from driving up here saying, hey, we're just displaying our wares. We're not selling these. If you want to buy them, get on the web and buy them from the manufacturer back in Arizona. And then, by the way, we'll deliver the things for you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, that's a lot of work and trouble to go through to do that. As you heard from Monty, a lot of show atmosphere is compulsive buying. You get them on the site. A lot of the sales tactics, obviously, you want to get them on there and sell them. When you have a vehicle, whether it's car, RV, you want that vehicle sitting out there while you're signing the paperwork and working through that, because that's what the excitement is, what makes drives the sale. That would be a lot of work, and I don't believe that would happen, but you never know. It's a good question.
Not to mention being extraordinarily expensive to move tons of RVs to another state. It's incredibly expensive.
I know. It's amazing they do it again. Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2565, and we're going to adjourn House Transportation Committee. Thank you.